Hey gang, did you know that our theme song is a real song called Needle Hits a Groove by a real band called Sheboygan on a real album called Triple Fantasy? Well, it is. You can get the album at iTunes or you can buy the vinyl album at cdbaby.com or at Waterloo Records in Austin, Texas. The LPs come with the download card as well. That's Sheboygan Triple Fantasy, available on LP or digital download at cdbaby.com. I've got it. I've got the vinyl. I've been rocking it the last few days. I've also got it on digital, so I do what I can when I'm jamming Sheboygan. That's Sheboygan. Get their album, Triple Fantasy. Let's get down. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Right. Hello. I am Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. If this is the first time you're tuning in, I talk to musicians and people in the music business. Like today, my guest is Dan Workman. He is a producer engineer that has worked with Destiny's Child, ZZ Top, Beyonce, and many, many more. He is the president of Sugar Hill Studios in Houston, Texas, and we met backstage at the House of Blues and did a podcast there. Do you hear this music in the background? Normally, there's no music when I'm doing this, right? You know what that is? Holy shit, guys. Corey Glazer, this week on Monday, gave me a turntable and some speakers, and I went out and found a good receiver for a very reasonable price, and then I got in the vinyl game, people. Right now, I'm spinning Joe Jackson's Night and Day. So yeah, I've been playing Sheboygan. Of course, that was the first jam I did, who did our title, our theme song. And I got T-Rex's Slider, I got Kiss Rock and Roll Over, I got Joe Jackson Night and Day, I got Pretenders 2, found great prices on records, and then actually woke up one morning and I don't know, it is an addicting thing. It's addictive or addicting, whichever one. It's addictive. It totally is. Like the you want to go get more. And I need more. So if you have duplicates, you're out there, you're a band out there, you just put out a vinyl album, I'd love to listen to it on my turntable. Thank you, Corey Glazer. And man, awesome stuff, man. You know, he gave me a few albums. He gave me Todd Rundgren, Runt, and also Todd Rundgren, A Wizard, A True Star, which is such an inspiring album. It's totally fucking crazy and just awesome. And the thing is it came from, we both just read Todd Rundgren's book, A Wizard, A True Star, which is about his recordings, which is really exciting. Bands he produced and his own recordings, stuff with Utopia. It's very, very cool album. Bad Out of Hell, the whole thing. So anyway, I want to thank Corey again. Great suggestion for the book. Thank you for the records and, of course, the turntable and speakers. All right, living in a new world. I'm getting ready to go play with Skyrocket at the Belmont. This is, of course, the day before this comes out. It's Thursday night. And then we're off for the weekend, which is very, very different for us. So I'm here and I'm doing that. I'm pretty excited about this whole turntable thing. I'm probably going to do a little record shopping this weekend. And man, you can find records, great prices. I got this album for $2.99, Joe Jackson Night and Day. What an exciting thing, huh? Fuck yeah! Hey, so my guest today is Dan Workman. He's a producer and engineer. He's worked with ZZ Top, Destiny's Child, Beyonce, and many, many more. He is the president of Sugar Hill Studios. He is also a producer and co-host of the show, the web series called Live from Sugar Hill, which you can find on YouTube. Has a lot of great performances, even from people that have been on the show. Susanna Schaffel, Van Wilkes, Sarah Sharp. Also people like even the Lynch Mob with George Lynch. Anyway, I reached out to Dan, and I was impressed with his work and sort of like all the different things that he did, and so he agreed to be on the show. So we met backstage at the House of Blues in Houston before my show there, and Skyrocket was playing, and so in between soundcheck and the gig, we sat down, we had a talk. It's a little noisy, and it's kind of like this intro. Anyway, sorry, I had to play the record while I was doing this because I'm so excited about the vinyl. Anyway, it's a little bit noisy. The DJ started spinning, and even though we closed the door, it still was a little bit noisy. But enjoy our conversation. Dan's a great guy. He's super inspiring to talk to. He's been doing this a long time, and he's really worked with a lot of different people. He tells great stories, Grammy stories, all kinds. All right? So here's my friend, Dan Workman, from backstage at the House of Blues in Houston, Texas, a few weeks ago. Let's get down. The other day,
I saw that on your site.
I was looking around and I saw your show, and I was blown away. And I watched a few episodes or checked out, you know, a few amazing sounding show, great looking. What do you use? Like three cameras or something?
One camera shoot.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
It's all POV. We've only done one show where we've had more than one camera, and we haven't released that. That was a show with the avant-garde artist Jandek.
Jandek?
Mm-hmm.
Who's that?
Well, that's interesting. If you have to ask, you're way on the outside of his cult audience. It's a guy that has been putting out records here in Houston, is an avant-garde artist for over 35 years, and he has a huge cult following long before it was easy to have one.
Right.
And so we have done production for him for a long time. For many years, it was real mysterious as to who this guy was, and he kept his identity hidden, and then it finally kind of dribbled out that he's from Houston. We've done a lot of production for him over the years at Sugar Hill, so he agreed to do a show there for live from Sugar Hill, and it was a ridiculous 10-camera shoot going from the simple one-camera shoot that we normally do, and that was the closer show. We took a year off to edit that.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
How many are you? You're still doing it? Still active?
We are not active right now. We literally took 2013 off to rethink the show. We all love doing it, but it's a labor of love, which I'm sure you can understand.
I totally understand.
With our partners in film, and we're going to kind of reinvent it a little bit. What we will keep is the fact that it's incredibly raw. Like when we do the show, it's the studio looks like it. It looked like when we finished our session for the day.
Yeah.
And there's no pretense about it.
No, that's what I like about it.
Yeah, it's totally what you get. And we love making records sort of in a live way at the studio anyway. The
kind of
rooms were built for that.
Yeah.
So when we have our guests come in and they play live, literally it's like the needle drops and the boat leaves and we just keep going until we can't go anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what you get. We don't do too much editing at all.
I don't do any. So see?
Yeah.
I think about this because I feel like in the old days of the talk shows, like when you would see someone like Burt Reynolds go on Johnny Carson, those guys had a rapport and they kind of talked about stuff and he'd plug his thing that he needed to plug. But now it's so regimented and all that stuff that I think that this sort of like between podcasts, people's YouTube stuff, people are creating real conversations again.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And there's something interesting that happens too, and I've noticed that in the show, and I bet you've noticed it as well, and that is when we have like one of the really old guys, like somebody that's 60 plus, that's a performer that's on the show, and they get it that the microphone is this giant audience that they're talking to, like right now.
Yeah.
And we have the younger guys come into the studio to do the show, like they want to be real quiet between songs and like, you know, very tentative about talking to anybody. And so I think that YouTube and the more immediate production value stuff reconnects you with your audience. Like right now I'm very aware of the fact that we're having a conversation that includes a lot of people, you know, and that's a really cool thing that it elevates it to performance.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of people are, you know, especially in the studio environment, performance is not really what they're thinking about. It's thinking about like refining something to perfection.
Right. Right.
Which is, you know, can be cool, but at the same time can lose an awful lot, you know?
Yeah. So tell me about Sugar Hill Studios. It's the oldest... Hold on. Whoa, hang on. The stage. okay, so there's going to be a stop there. So tell me about Sugar Hill. It's the oldest studio in the United States, even older than ones in L.A.?
Yeah, it really is. The only studio that we're aware of in the world that's any older is Abbey Road, which is coming up on around 80 years old. Abbey Road Studios.
Where is that?
In England. Yeah, not in the United States. In the United States, nobody has tried to argue with our 73 years old, just turned 73. So it's really unusual. You would expect it to be in New York or L.A.
Yeah, and that's where Archie Bell and the Drill recorded the Tighten Up?
Yeah. Well, you know, no. That's part of the lore, but the actual history is that they recorded all the demos for it at Sugar Hill. But it was baked into the story when we bought the business.
Yeah.
And it was only after we wrote the book did we start to find out some of the surprising cool things that
were
recorded there. Yeah, there's a book called Hits from the Hill.
Why didn't I know that?
Well, it's available on Amazon, and it's both a scholarly work as well as a really cool read. It's tons of stories. It has a full discography of all the people that have ever recorded at Sugar Hill and charted.
I just was reading a book this week, a biography about Todd Rundgren's production work, and he went there on a break on a tour and recorded a tune, right?
Yeah, he did. And that was kind of common back in the earlier days of touring. You know, bands would hit town and they'd do three or four shows at the Coliseum or Jones Hall or whatever, and they would come in and they would record, you know, while they were in town. So The Who actually did that, The Stones, you know, a lot of the bigger rock bands, a lot of the other itinerant artists would come through and record at Sugar Hill. I wasn't there. I was still busy being a kid, but you know, it was happening.
Well, now in all this modern, obviously it's, do you still have tape machines?
Yeah, we do. We have tape machines in Studio A and Studio B, as well as, you know, all the computer stuff that we normally have. We got built-in chambers and, you know, EMT plate reverb. So we've got a lot of the old stuff, and we got all the new stuff as well.
Yeah. And so, well, tell me about this, because when did you take over?
My partners and I bought the business in 1996.
Okay.
And while I had been recording and building recording studios in Houston since, like, the late 1980s, that was when we actually took over the business.
All right. And you're an engineer?
I am an engineer-producer.
Okay, an engineer-producer. And some of your credits are?
Well, I've done ZZ Top.
Yes.
Van Wilkes, as a matter of fact, a record that never came out. Beyonce, Destiny's Child, Clay Walker, Lil Wayne, South Park Mexican. I've been very privileged. I've gotten a chance to do almost everybody that's really big in Houston. And since I decided to stay here instead of, like, going to L.A. or New York.
Right.
You know, Houston's been really good to me, and I've got a chance to work with, like, the very best, I think.
Yeah. And you stay busy?
I do.
And do you still get a lot of people coming in from other places to do stuff, or?
Do you know, it's odd, we do. People are aware of sort of, like, the legend of the studio, and if they're really super fans of a legacy artist and they have the means, they come to us. We've had people come as far away from Vienna, Austria to come record with us, and then, you know, people from various parts of the United States, mostly because they want a sound of a record that was done there.
Yeah. How'd you get started? What was the... You're a musician. You
started out playing. I was a musician long before I was an engineer. I was playing in bands in the 80s.
Here in Houston. Any bands I would know?
The only band that I played in that really achieved some critical success was a band called Culture Side. And we were sort of like an art rock noise band that started from 1980. And we toured the United States, we toured Europe, and we had, you know, a rabid fan base of probably 500 people that read the right magazines and thought,
right, cool.
You know what I mean? And it was awesome for us. And it was, you know, challenging, experimental music, and I just absolutely fell in love with being a musician. I mean, I'd played in cover bands, like in high school and that kind of stuff, in college. Once I started playing original music, especially very odd, weird original music, I was hooked.
Yeah.
I really, this is what I wanted to do, but I had no desire to be an engineer. I'd go into the recording studio, and I kind of thought all the gear was cool, and I kind of thought the people that were working in the studio were neat.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was not until I met a guy named Scott Ayers here in Houston that played in a band called Alien Labor, and later in the Pain Teens, and became a great producer.
Yeah.
Well, Scott used to have
part of the Axiom scene in the late 80s. Yeah, I remember him.
Yeah, and he had a reel-to-reel, like, Tascam tape deck. It was a TAC 3340, which you could overdub on, and we would all, like, go over to his house and get high on Saturday and, like, just record all day long.
Yeah.
And it just kept going, and I got the bug, and so I just kept buying gear and recording everything I could, and the next thing I knew, I was buying books to try to teach myself. It never occurred to me to find a mentor or to go to school for it. I just bought every magazine and every book and just every piece of gear I could.
I went to school here for it.
Did you? Where'd you go?
Yeah, at HCC.
I taught courses at HCC for about 4 years. I stopped 2 years ago. I taught a production course there from 4 years ago to 2 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, this was like 1987, 88.
Yeah, I wasn't quite there. I was still busy getting ready to really launch my career.
So you just hands-on. You just kind of like...
I did, which is a terrible way to learn it, but a great way.
It's not a terrible way. I think that's the way a lot of people... Like, I started on four-track, and all of the principles apply to everything.
Totally. I found that I loved not only the gear... But I really loved getting inside people's heads and trying to help them get what they wanted to sound a certain way.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And it made me really happy to be an engineer for a long time. But then I started to have a bunch of opinions how people's stuff should sound, which was very dangerous because being an engineer, you can kind of like hide behind the fact that they can't really sing and make everything else sound great and had this wonderful experience and, you know, lead them down the path.
And a lot of times, an engineer's best way to keep his job is to keep his mouth.
Yeah, you keep your mouth shut. And you keep invested in the project in whatever way you can. Maybe it's really cool people. Maybe they're not so cool, but their music's awesome. Maybe there's one guy that can't play, but he's, you know, you're going to help him out. But when I started to have a lot of opinions, then it was time to become a producer. Yeah. And I actually stopped engineering over about a period of a year and a half and said, that's it. I'm only going to work on projects that I have sort of, you know, creative input on.
Right.
And I did pretty well. You know, and I probably had my biggest clients as an engineer, but as a producer, it was just like so awesome to be able to, you know, craft somebody's music from the ground up.
Yeah.
With bands, it was a certain way of working. With singer-songwriters, it was another. And it took me a lot of really cool places. And I've met so many different people and made a
zillion. What did you do with ZZ?
That was really interesting. Billy Gibbons called Rock and Robin Guitars and Music, and I was working there, and this was around 1987. And
with Gary Wade?
Yeah, it was.
On Tuesday.
Yeah,
I love those guys.
Gary, as a matter of fact, Raz Mathias.
Raz is one of my best friends.
He just dropped me some Facebook love yesterday.
He did?
Hadn't heard from him in ages.
But yeah.
I was working there, and I answered the phone, and it was Billy Gibbons, and it was like, he was asking if there was somebody there that knew how to program a guitar synthesizer, and I was like, whoa.
Like a GR-707 or something? Some kind of thing like that?
Yes,
that,
exactly.
Like razor
blade? He had all the gear built into a really cool guitar.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have the anything
he wouldn't have
normal.
That weird looking guitar.
So I said I could do it, and so he said, well, here's my address, come on over. And which was a big problem for me because, number one, I really hadn't done that much with guitar synthesizers. Number two, Billy Gibbons, like ZZ Top, was one of my biggest, you know, hero bands.
Yeah.
And so I was getting ready to go over to one of my heroes' houses, and I pulled it off, and I helped him, and I worked for him a little bit, and then he asked me what I knew about building recording studios, and I just built like a little home studio, an 8-track, and I said, well, you know, it's funny, I just built one. And so he takes me out to his garage.
What year was this?
This was 88.
Okay.
He takes me out to his garage, and he opens up the door, and it's packed, so packed he can't get his car in there, with all the gear for a full-on 32-track digital studio. And he goes, like, what can you do with this? And it was a real turning point for me because I realized the true answer was, I have no fucking idea. But but that wasn't the answer I was going to give him.
No,
because
of course
you
not.
Only get, you know, you only get so many opportunities like this. So I said, well, I think I can build you a studio. And so 2 days later, we signed a lease on a place over on Post Oak Road. And 2 days after that, I'm meeting with contractors. And it was one of those moments where it was a test of your mettle because I had to figure it all out fast. And I had to hit the phone and I had to read the books. And I built him a studio.
You had like one of the world's biggest and most recognizable rock stars, 88. That was fucking...
It was intense. And
was he working with the Fairlight?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact...
What is a fucking Fairlight?
Okay, well, a Fairlight was an early version of a sampler recorder.
Okay.
Like, it had a rudimentary sequencer in it,
right.
So you could actually record stuff into it and play it back. You could also, actually record like you would in Logic. But it was very, very primitive.
Did you have a screen and stuff?
Yeah, it had a screen.
What was on the screen?
just literally
words.
Yes,
green,
it,
that
it
green
had like a weird grid for the sequencer with triangles where you would like place the different samples so you could do drum parts and stuff. Or you could. It had a regular 88 key weighted keyboard as well as like a computer keyboard and a light pen. It was just really crazy. The light pen was awesome. And I first saw him being used on stage with like Yes, like Rick Wakeman.
Right.
And I thought, oh man, that's incredible. And I had read that Gibbons was using one on Eliminator, and that's how they got all the crazy sampled sounds with
okay.
it. So he was into it. It was weird. It was a blues guy that was into this cutting-edge modern equipment. They actually had two of them, and they were about $200,000 a piece. And it was he sent me to Nashville to learn how to use it. It was awesome. I mean, I was, you know, I was a kid or a young adult, and it was like, what is going on? But I, once again, I kind of pulled it off, and that got me in on the digital revolution way early. And
yeah.
I was really kind of grateful. So I was working with old microphones and ancient cool guitars and, you know, classic analog recording equipment in the Fairlight. And so that was the thing that kind of opened my head up to like, well, we can use anything we want to.
Right? Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a good primer for winding
up. So what were they like to work with once you started working? Was it intimidating? Were they in a...
I was in a constant state of shit your pants.
Yeah. And especially the level of success that they were trying to back
right.
up.
Yeah, well, they were trying to
right?
keep that going. After
yeah,
Afterburner,
yeah.
I mean, you know, they sold 16 million records
yeah.
for Warner Brothers.
And there was a thing where you could put like a triangulated beard and sunglasses as just a thing in a hat and you'd know exactly
you know
what
who
that
it was.
Was. Yeah.
Right. And the little lightning
bulb. Fucking one of the most brilliant.
The furry
PR
guitars.
Of
remember the furry guitars?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was intimidating in the sense that I was very aware that this was, I would have no other opportunity better than this to like work in the business. So that was intimidating. Billy himself was charming, awesome.
One of the
he
nicest guys, I think, in the music business.
Totally.
Yeah.
And brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I mean, Billy is a walking piece of performance art. He literally creates this comic book reality around him, and you get sucked into it because his vibe is so heavy. And I'm sure if you spend any time with him, you know that he's kind, he's awesome.
So kind.
He has brilliant ideas, you know, just all the time.
Also, he came to see, I was doing a show with, remember Storyville?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Grissom and,
sure.
and Holt in it, and those guys.
I met Grissom through Gibbons.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So Grissom and our friends, and so are Holt and I, and Malford and stuff, and so he was like, oh, come on, I want you to meet the Reverend after
right.
we played. And he was so complimentary. Like, at the end of my show, it was like this giant feedback fucking thing, and people throwing shit everywhere. And he thought it was great, and I was so flattered.
Yeah. Well, that's
so giving. He was super giving.
He is.
And then someone would come up behind and be like, oh, Billy. And they just stop. Hey, what can I give you of myself, basically, is what he did.
Now, you just identified something about him that I've noticed in a few other people that I've considered real superstars, and that is when they're talking to you, you're the only person in the world.
Yes.
And because they're them.
Yeah.
I mean, you are.
It's very heavy. And
it
I
is
think
very
that
heavy.
I've read some stuff about, I just read a Rolling Stone thing like yesterday about Paul McCartney. He's very aware of what it means when he comes up and makes a joke to you.
Right.
And he's doing it, disarms you, you're cool, and
yeah.
plus you got a moment.
Right.
With this.
Right. Well, I'm sure that it serves them, because otherwise that you walk around stunned individuals all the time and
sure.
you can't have any human interaction.
And I like the fact that somebody took it as wow, all these people like me. That's really nice. You know what I mean? Some people are put off by it. Like, oh, why do you like me?
Right.
I could see myself being really famous and just getting annoyed because someone liked me.
It just proves how stupid they are, right?
Exactly. What's wrong with you?
Totally. Well, anyway, you know, to pick up the thread, you know, working with Billy was fantastic and opened the doors, and also kind of opened the door for me to stay in Houston, because after working with him, I was busy. I had lots of work, and I enjoyed being here. My family was here,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know the other things that were in store for me. I kind of thought, well, maybe I've peaked, you know, maybe this is it.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, that would have been fine.
Right.
But it wasn't, and I'm forever grateful to Billy. And it's funny, I will run into him, not around here in Houston, but I'll go into a random bar. The last time I met up with him randomly was in L.A. after the Grammys. We went to a bar that Jay-Z was supposed to be having a party. And of course, we couldn't get in. My wife and my entourage, we couldn't get in to see Jay-Z, which was fine. None of us knew him. But at the bar is Billy Gibbons sitting there buying drinks for everybody. And my wife, I don't drink, but my wife makes up for that. And so I go up there, and by the time like I've kind of made the rounds and talked to everybody, my wife is sitting there singing her favorite ZZ Top guitar solos to Billy Gibbons at the bar in this crazy place in LA. And I was like, you know, this is like one of those cool moments in life. You know, my wife and Billy are like having this moment. Of course, she's under his spell.
Yeah.
And she's like singing her favorite ZZ guitar parts.
And he's totally cool with it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Probably flattered.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I don't know if my business with Gibbons is done or not, but I will be forever grateful to him. Forever grateful.
Good.
He opened a lot of doors for me.
And so then after you did that stuff, you had a name around town. Obviously, people would be like, hey, want to work with that guy that just did some ZZ Top stuff?
Sure. I mean, and, you know, that's the way it works in the production world.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're sort of lifted up on your credits. The thing that was cool about staying in Houston for me was that instead of making ZZ Top records for the rest of my life, I opened up into huge diversity.
Yeah.
I cut tons of punk rock records. I did a lot of Spanish rock records, like from the mid-90s to about 2000. I did a lot of Spanish rock
records.
That's
the exploding rock and Espanol time.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then about that time, I got hooked in with Destiny's Child. And that was another random moment. And there was a phone call. My wife was...
Was Teresa the one that signed them?
Teresa LaBarrel White. Yeah, she was...
It's always like one of those things where like you go around and I mean nothing by this. But I just remember like she courted my band and like we'd go up to Dallas and do all this shit. And then I remember one time talking to my manager like, hey, they want us to do something. They need to send in some more weight than Teresa, who's always super nice.
Sure.
And always...
She was a hippie chick, right?
And a great person after.
Right.
Like, I got a deal with somebody else, and we ended up being friends, and always great. But, like, I remember seeing a thing going, like, wow, that was Teresa that did that.
Right.
Was it Teresa that did that?
It was. She, Matthew Knowles, courted, you know how it works.
Yeah.
Matthew's, like, trying to front his daughter's band. They've got one sort of look at me hit with the Wyclef Jean song that was on the first record. I can't even remember what it was. Teresa had listened to Matthew and had given him the shot. And as a result, both their stars rose rather quickly.
Totally.
And by the time they did the second record, which
didn't
is when I came
on board.
Didn't
she also end up signing Christina Aguilera or someone like that?
I don't remember about that, but you could be right because they were on tour together.
Yeah,
they were on tour together.
I saw her on like a Behind the Music thing and I was like, well, she got them too?
What? Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because she got Destiny's Child hooked up with Shakespeare, Kevin Briggs, who did TLC's No Scrubs.
Right, right, right.
And that's when I got involved.
Okay.
So I got involved when things were heating up quite a bit. But I saw them struggle at the beginning, and then it just all blew up. By the time they did the third album, Survivor, it was all over with.
Did you do Survivor?
I did some of the vocals on Survivor. I did most of the vocals.
I love that song.
Great.
I love them.
Probably the coolest thing that I did with them was that song Bootylicious.
Oh, yeah.
The one that's, it has the On the Edge of 17 sample.
Yeah,
Stevie Nicks. And my truck had broken down. Beyonce was at the studio kind of waiting on me with Kelly Rowland. And I got there and I'm all flustered. And she says, play the song. And so we play the loop over and over. And she sits down and writes the song, like, right there in the studio. I mean, just writes it straight up.
Right.
And when it all came together, she goes into the studio, and we cut vocals for about 8 hours straight. I mean, no break. We, break to go to the bathroom, that kind of thing. And it's done. And it's, like, it's amazing. And the next day, Matthew called me up for sort of like the situation report. It's like, what'd y'all do yesterday? And I said, well, we got a whole song done, and it's really awesome. It's called Bootylicious. And Matthew Knowles goes, Bootylicious? And I'm like, no, it's like this female empowerment song. Matthew, you're going to really love it. It's really awesome. And it's more like silence on the other. He goes, Bootylicious? He goes, no. And I said, just listen to it.
Yeah.
I sent the rough over. Just check it out. Could see what you think. And of course, it was giant hit song. And it was just so cool to be a part of that.
Yeah.
You know? And there was other instances of that, working on a little bit of stuff on her first solo record. I played some guitar parts, and it was like, all of a sudden, boom, I'm playing on a song that's a Grammy Award-winning song. Boom. I engineered vocals on a Grammy Award-winning LP and a bunch of songs. It was just, amazing.
I'm going to ask you a couple of things. First of all, when you first came across her, how did you get it? Were you like, this is going to be somebody?
She was 15.
And you see them at 15, do you see the future when you meet them?
Okay, so here's the deal. You know, when they first called up the studio to do some demos for that second record, I didn't know who they were. And my wife is like, there's this guy, Matthew Knowles. I'm like, great, great, I'll do the session. Matthew drops her off. I don't meet him at all. She comes in. She's really pretty, super, super nice. You know, we're making nice talk and meeting each other while I'm getting set up. And she has some tracks, and I slot the tracks and open up the microphone. And within about 20 minutes, I was pretty sure that she might be the best singer I'd ever heard. Certainly ever recorded. Yeah. Let's say ever recorded. And by the time we finished that session, which was about 2 hours, we laid down vocals on about 4 different songs. I didn't know anything about the R&B scene. Nothing. That's another one of the Houston things happening. Here I am in this whole different world again. And she goes, let's do the B section first. I'm like, okay, I just have to ask, like, what is the B section? I don't even know. She's talking about the bridge. Okay,
right. But
I don't know. And we really hit it off. You know, I'm kind of the geeky older guy like knows nothing of her world, but I'm a good engineer, and you know, she felt at home.
And
she
a good hang, probably.
Yeah, a good hang. Yeah. And she was like, you know, the awesomely nice, awesomely pretty, amazingly talented girl who's got some stuff going on.
Yeah.
So that started it, and she must have told her dad that she enjoyed working with us, and we just kept working together. And, you know, that... If I'd been in New York and had done ZZ Top, I would have just still been doing ZZ Top bands, you know, because you get concentrated, you get kind of streamlined into what you're doing in a really hyper dense market like that. But in Houston, it was like, whoa!
Yeah,
okay, I'm the R&B guy.
Stuff,
I made so many R&B records. Oh,
well, I'm sure
gosh.
Once you did the Beyonce,
right.
Or once you did the Destiny's
But
Child.
After 5 years, I started doing Spanish rock records.
Right.
Wasn't quite as glamorous.
No,
budgets weren't as big. And then, you know, got into some weird rap stuff, and you know, like then I found myself with Cash Money in the studio. And
how was that?
Man,
it's
was
a different world.
It was terrible. It was not a very like super friendly, awesome, cool, warm, and fuzzy environment. But I did get to work with Lil Wayne.
How was that?
Oh, it was awesome. That was the 30 minutes I really liked.
Was he on the syrup at the time?
He was on Cash Money at the time. This was before him and Baby kind of like came to their bad place. But it was amazing of all the guys that they brought, because they're constantly running their farm team through, you know, and they had the studio.
What do you mean they're running their farm team?
Well, they bring a zillion guys,
right.
And they have this record they want to make, but then they have all the other guys like just pile on and try some stuff out. And Lil Wayne was cool, but he wasn't very well known.
Okay.
He was so good. He was so good in the studio. He was the only guy that went in there not shuffling papers, and he just, like, you hit the light and he just performed. Just like once, like talking about the microphone.
He's
singing to a million people the second the light comes on. He blew me
away. That's so cool. You can kind of tell with those people.
He just threw his lyrics on the floor, did the deal, and walked away and knew he had done right. You know, it was cool. It would made 3 weeks of hell into really kind of worth it, because I had that experience. And you know, I did a few other things in the rap world.
When guys are recording rap albums, were you guys going from samples and like people had already made beats, or were they coming in and making the beats in your place?
It's
or
funny,
were you working from original points, or what were you doing?
Well, with Cash Money, they brought in their whole team, and it was Manny Fresh, who was basically the beat master, but at the same time, he had about 5 or 6 live musicians with him in the studio at all times. And so we had drums set up, we had guitar set up, and you know, they were big believers in tracking everything on analog tape, so it was very different from a normal rap session even back then. I mean
it's really cool.
Totally cool.
Yeah.
Well, that was another thing that kind of made up for it. Manny Fresh was cool. He was a really cool guy.
Yeah.
He treated us nicely. Baby and Slim were, you know, over it, and you know, we were just sort of means to an end for them, and we were not used to being treated that way at all. Like,
right.
Normally, normally the hang was very, very important to us, and it wasn't in that case. Probably the other biggest rapper I worked for wasn't even in the room. I did records with Payne Ortiz for South Park Mexican, but I did it after SPM was in prison. It was on all of this material that they recorded right up before he goes to prison, because they know he's going away and it doesn't look good. So they just record him all the time, and they just had tons and tons of vocals and tons of beats. And we recorded this incredible record, and like he's never even there. You know, I mean, they're sending messages back and forth to prison. Oh yeah, they had like people going to visit him at every visiting time, so they could take the list of stuff as to what was being done. And
wow,
some of it he could listen to, and some of it he couldn't. And I wasn't very clear on, you know, the provenance on some of the vocals and whether it was legal or illegal. But it made for a fascinating experience for me, and I made a lot of friends in the rap world.
Were any guys like weird? Like, were there guys with guns in situations?
Never for Cash Money, and never with the Dope House guys. They were all super straight up.
Cool.
It was the Rap-A-Lot guys that had a big, you know, firearms and lots of money around type deal.
Yeah.
That's a whole other set of stories, none of which I'm really at liberty to talk about.
I wouldn't expect you to.
But I mean, that's really the cool part of being, you know, having made my living in Houston doing this, is like I've had all these very different experiences.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that kind of being here was the thing that stitched it all together. Houston's a really diverse place anyway. We're supposed to be the most diverse city in the United States.
A lot of expatriates, like I moved there because I couldn't do what I could do in Austin in 1991.
Right.
When I moved from here, I couldn't see myself really making a living as a musician.
Right.
Unless I made it and moved away.
Right.
So I was like, well, fuck it, I'll move to Austin. All my friends there work all the time, and it's,
right,
you know.
Right, and I go to Austin. I'm working there at least once a month.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Who are you working with up there? Anyone?
Right now, nobody.
Okay.
But Sarah Sharp, I've done some records with her.
A really great friend of mine. She's been on the show a couple times.
Really? Hey, yeah. Sarah.
Sarah.
Shout outs to Sarah. She's like one of my best friends.
Really? Yeah. She's one of my favorite entities. I like her because she's always doing stuff, and she's thinking beyond.
Oh, she's
little,
like,
the little world. She's
five steps
out there.
Beyond.
She's,
yeah. She's a smart lady, and you know, she's a great music director, and she's also a great. She does a little publishing on the side.
Yeah,
you know, so she's got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. So you went up there. Did you work with Jitterbug Vipers at all?
No. This all predates it. This was all her own singer-songwriter gig. And most of the work we did here in Houston, we cut one record here in Houston and one record up in Austin.
Okay. Let me ask you this. And this is a weird question, but from the time that you took over Sugar Hill Studios, the studio business has been much like the record business,
and it's changed.
There's been a couple of giant studios, but then everything, all that sort of like from the Sunset Sound and Ocean Ways, the next level is some dude's house.
You're right, and it's funny. I was just out in New York for the Audio Engineering Society show, and I saw Alan Sides, owner of Ocean.
Yeah, I love Alan.
And Kirk Imamura from Avatar, which used to be the Power Station, and Jeff, I believe it's Jeff Greenberg from Village Recorders out in LA.
I don't know him, but yeah.
Well, those are just like the biggest of the big studios left. I mean, and there's Blackbird.
And Alan has new microphones, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
In you know, there's a couple of really big ones still left in Nashville, maybe three or
there's
four.
There's an Ocean Way there, too. Right?
There is.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I think that is the Ocean Way now. I'm not sure that there's more than one location, but I could be wrong about that. But I know that they collapsed down. There was other Ocean Ways that they'd sell off. In Nashville, Blackbird Studios, John McBride, Martina McBride's husband, still has an awesome studio there. But for the most part, the really big rooms, the big box studios, as I like to call them, they're no more. And yes, the business has changed totally.
People don't buy records.
Say what?
People don't buy records.
Well, no, they don't. You know. And you know, until there's a critical mass of people that are on, you know, either Spotify Premium or either the high level streaming services, revenue sources for recording are really going to be bad. I mean, that's just the nature of the world right now. Now, the interesting thing is there's more people making records than ever before. And there's a lot of people who have fetishized the equipment, the experience of making records, and have bought all their own gear, you know, have their own studios in their home. I mean, you and I know dozens, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, myself.
Everyone in this band.
Yeah. So it's a different world. So there's enough sort of legend at Sugar Hill to attract people.
I get it.
There is enough sort of engineering experience between...
Right.
My guys and the guys that lease space from me at Sugar Hill, like, there's usually about 80 years of experience in the house every day, and that's a rarity now.
Yeah, and the one thing too is, like, a lot of these people's home studios, including my own, I can't record a band live.
Right, right. Or you can't do it what we would think of as proper.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah,
but we learned to work with the guys that were recording at home. As a matter of fact, in 2000, we published a story in Pro Sound News about how we really welcomed people that were setting up Pro Tools rigs in their house. We want them to come do their drums or do their vocals at our place or come mix at our place.
Right, right,
and
right.
So we got a reputation of being very friendly, like it was, you're not in competition with us.
Right.
You found out how cool it is and you're doing it.
Yeah.
And that helped us
tremendously.
And now the last thing that's kind of clicking into place, I looked at what they were doing at Village Recorders. I looked at what they were doing at Avatar. And that was taking smaller rooms and leasing them to producers to do what you do in your home, what I do in my office, but at Sugar Hill.
Yeah, I did a record that Jack Joseph Quigg mixed in Ocean Way, and he has, or had, I don't know if he still does, but he had a room there.
Yeah. And, well, like, for instance, you know, Chuck Ainley has got his place. I don't remember where it is now. He works a lot overseas. Who else? I mean, almost everybody's got their small little production rooms that they're mixing out of, that they're doing their work in.
Yeah.
So I'm leasing spaces like that to guys here in Houston. Steve Christensen, Josh Appleby, John Griffin, Chris Longwood all lease spaces for me. And
who's
I'm getting
Christensen? Who's that guy?
Steve Christensen, he did Ray Wiley Hubbard's last record.
Okay.
He also works a lot with, who was it? He did Steve Earle's Grammy Award winning record. Well, he's like one of our, he started out as a...
Like a star.
Yeah, well, he started out sweeping floors at Sugar Hill 15 years ago. So those guys, I now have them in-house, and they lease space from me, and we're sort of changing our business model to include not only the revenues from the studios, but leasing spaces out to people that want to be at Sugar Hill. So there's a lot of guys who don't want to be at home, and they have the bucks to... lease space at the business, and that they are at 5626 Brock Street with us and under the umbrella, and it's really cool. I mean, like, it's amazing. Like, like all the guys that I trained as engineers that were successful that kind of went out in the world, they're all back leasing space from me, and
that's great,
helping to pay the bills at Sugar Hill.
Are there still kids interested in coming and getting internships?
All the time, more than we can service.
Obviously, yeah.
There's more people wanting the door of being in the business than there are sort of commercial slots to put them in.
Right.
So when I was teaching at HCC, when we were talking about that, I mean, one of the things that I really ingrained is that you're going into business for yourself. You're going to have to carve out a business, unless you're going to work like at a big, you know, production facility for a company or a church or something like that, or a broadcast agency. More than likely, you're not going to be showing up and trying to get a job at a big box recording studio, because look around, there's not that many of them left.
Right.
So you're going to be in business for yourself, like I was when I started. And most, there's some people that really get that. They really get it. So I've got some really cool young people that are...
That's awesome.
You know, trying to make it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jonathan Chan, man, John Gell. I've got one guy, John Gell, who decided he liked film and location sound, and he's just making it happen. He's like, he's on the movies. He's never at Sugar Hill anymore. He's always on a movie. He's on a shoot.
It's so cool because the technology has moved to the point where you can go out and hustle your own thing. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, like, when you and I got started... Really, a lot of the motivation for me to be an engineer, you were the priest in the temple of gear that no one else can afford and is too expensive and too complicated for you to use. And, like, that's gone.
I had a completely different motivation.
Mine
was, if I can learn how to do this, then I can record my own fucking band and not
wait
on anyone or pay
anyone. That's far more modern.
Yeah.
That's far more than the modern motivation. It's really people get into it because they want to do their own thing.
Yeah.
I got into it because I love to record and make things sound right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's okay. That's just sort of like a difference of the times a little bit.
Yeah. So, now your business How many rooms do you have? How many studios?
We've got two studios, and I've leased out four other small studios, and I'm building another for another production company.
Wow. So you're still growing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not on wood.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a lot right next door to Sugar Hill where I can put more production rooms if that looks like what the future is. I'm in it for the long run. I mean, I love making records. I love music. I love to play. I still play.
Yeah.
So I really just am not too concerned about the supposed limitations around it. I mean, I'm a real world practical guy. I don't have my head in the clouds. That's why I've gone to New York and talked to Kirk at Avatar. That's why I've gone to LA and talked to Jeff Greenberg. What's working? How do we make this thing work? So I think I'm going to own a big box recording studio for a long time.
Good.
And
good, because
it's
they
much
need
to my
still
surprise.
Be there. And it's cool that you had the openness. I'll come record your drums, or come bring your home recording. We'll mix
Please.
It.
Yeah, and you know, it's really weird. I have to mention, I have the best partners in the world too. Andy Bradley who's one of my partners at Sugar Hill, was my mentor in the business. When I finally found a mentor, he was it. And he has a huge clientele now. I mean, like, he's billing time and booking hours and in the studio more than he really wants to be. And then my other partner, Rodney Myers, helped us build the place. Like, we really renovated the control rooms, rebuilt everything in Sugar Hill. He's an amazing builder. He used to have an incredible mastering business. So I just lucked into finding the right guys. But we're all in it for the long term.
Yeah. How do people find it? Like, with Sugar Hill Studios, Google it?
Yeah, there's two different ways people get to us. Well, there's three. And the internet's been very kind to us. But there's people that are interested in legacy bands, whether they're well-known or not, and they find out that it was done at Sugar Hill, and they want to be at Sugar Hill for that reason. The other reason is my guys. The people that work there are so talented.
Yeah.
And so they generate business. You know, somebody wants a record that sounds like that. And we still have very young bands that come in, which I'm very grateful for.
Yeah.
And then finally, the internet was kind of, we jumped on that bandwagon hot and hard. We have a great web presence. We always have.
And I like that you have the show, too. I think that,
yeah.
I thought, when I saw that, I was like, man, more studios should do that.
Well, a lot of them do now.
Isn't it Abbey Road that had that show? Where
Abbey Road has a show.
Like, it was,
Abbey Road.
It was like Nigel Godrich with Radiohead and
Record
Live or something.
Yeah, they've done that. But Abbey Road has its own series of live stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So does, gosh, there's a really great one in Memphis, too. John Fry's studio, which I'm flashing on. Arden Studios. Arden has an incredible, incredible archive of artists that they've done live.
Huh. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is. Do you know John? Have you ever worked in his place?
No, I met Jody Stevens, South by Southwest, who was repping, the drummer.
Jody's
Big
worked
Star.
With me for the Grammys.
Oh, yeah?
And he is one of the nicest guys.
He's a really nice guy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I got a chance to play on stage with him.
And really?
Like, that was a big moment. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, I was playing with Big Star's drummer.
Yeah. Yeah, no shit. Are you a Big Star guy?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you notice any kind of, what's going on with music? You have a lot of, is there electronic guys coming to you, or they don't need to?
Well, they don't need to.
But they do.
But that influence now is like so pervasive. It's sort of like, remember when people started using the hip hop, you know, drum beats
and
stuff? Yeah. And so like, you're doing a hip hop record, even though it's not, and so.
Well, even like singer-songwriters are coming with their hip hop beat.
Right,
their loop.
Exactly. Well, EDM is so pervasive now that people are doing that. Matter of fact, I was just listening to the new Todd Rundgren record.
Total EDM. I listened to it a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
But it's good.
Yeah, it's great.
I was tripping.
But he was like, he's into dance music.
Well, he can be into whatever he wants.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have people that do show up to do that. That is rather self-contained, and it is rather.
It's not like a group of people. You can use a small like mixing studio almost to do it.
Yeah, we just don't see very much of it because it is very self-contained,
sure.
And very independent. And the EDM world it's recent enough to where they never really saw themselves in the studio. I mean, if you go back to Kraftwerk, which is like sort of the beginning of that branch of the tree, that was a very studio intensive thing. But very quickly, starting with like you know that with MIDI, like in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It became more and more easy to do that without having any sort of a soundstage. If you don't need the soundstage, you don't need the studio ultimately. So we don't get a lot of that. However, a lot of my guys that are engineering and producing out of Sugar Hill are definitely involved in it. So that I'm hearing it up and down the halls.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, and like, you know, I got to meet Skrillex 2 years ago at the Grammys.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and it was, you know, I just like, man, that sound, how did you get that sound? He just laughed, and it was like it was a mistake. You know, I mean, like...
What, the dubstep?
Yeah.
A mistake?
It was for him.
A $1 million mistake.
A million dollar mistake. It was like, you know, he didn't have much to say about it. He was just a really nice, quiet guy. You want to meet my girlfriend? I was like, yeah. That was it. That was the end of that conversation. But
wow.
I love keeping up with it, and you know, music is an evergreen subject. I mean, and the literature is being added too. The kind of the hard thing now is that there's so much of it. You know, the bookstore of music is this gigantic place because everything's published.
Yeah.
There's no filter. You know, it's
no.
Like everything's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything. Let me ask you this: are there? Oh wait, Eric Jarvis just texted. I don't know what he said. Are people still coming and they're asking for tape? Are any of them like newer? Are they young punk bands, rock bands, or country bands trying to keep a warm sound? Or
yes, it's there's fewer people that are coming and asking for tape. But those that do are very insistent that that's what they want. They want that experience of hearing it come back off a tape. And it's, for those that can identify it, it's a heavy spice. You know, they want it. They want that experience of having roll tape, working on the machine. They want the constraints around that. But it's an idyllic, wonderful thing. It's an intangible.
Yeah.
Like the thing that they really want isn't the reel of tape. It's that feeling of, you know, recording in a way that the masters of the past have done it, and they want to be a part of that tradition.
Yeah.
So it's really cool. It's like people that, you know, ride horses really, really seriously, you know, like,
right.
They want that experience of riding a horse.
Yeah, they don't want to ride a mechanical bull. I don't know what that has to do with anything.
No.
So what about you? What's your preference? Do you miss tape? Do you...
No, not one bit. Now, I didn't miss it when I first started working in the digital world. I missed things about the sound of it tremendously. And I'm glad that the digital world has gotten better sounding.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, for rock and roll drums, it's really hard to beat what happens when you hit tape with it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's really
And
difficult.
There was one thing that got me, that took me years to get past, was like, you know, from being 4-track and then, you know, 8-track and then a reel-to-reel.
Me too.
And all that stuff that I would push, you know, oh, if you hit it harder, it'll compress. Sure. Let's hit it hard. That's a hard thing to back off from. It was for me.
Oh my God.
It was just hard.
It's totally hard.
I would have this horrible sounding, like you couldn't, everything couldn't be in the red and sound super cool.
No, you have to learn a totally different way of recording and mixing.
It's like a mirror, like a real mirror that you can't manipulate.
Well, see, that was the thing that was so fortunate for me, because when I was just coming off this big self-education jag, I had an 8-track reel-to-reel.
Right.
And then I met Billy Gibbons.
Yeah.
And so then I'm working with 32-track Mitsubishi digital machines and Fairlights and analog machines all side by side. And so I quickened. I sort of came of age with all the tools.
You quickly got it, yeah.
Yeah. So I just figured it out.
Great. What do you have coming through that you're excited about? Anything exciting?
Sure. I'm producing a second record for a Houston band called the Wheel Workers, and I really like this band a lot. They deal with heavy political subjects, but like with really melodic, friendly, fun to listen to music.
Cool.
And that's an odd combination, real odd combination.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes me feel like what I did listening to protest music in the 60s when I was a young kid. But at the same time, it's not just sort of like... The last real protest music I paid attention to was Rage Against the Machine, which is kind of like a heavy, heavy thing, you know?
Yeah.
And like, this is not as heavy. This is more sort of like if Radiohead was highly political, but had a bigger sense of humor. So I love this band.
That's
and so
great.
I'm working heavily with Stephen Higginbotham, the leader of the band, the sort of the creator. I'm way off into that. And I'm also interested in doing some more avant-garde my stuff myself. I've worked with Two Star Symphony and did a piece with them 2 years ago, and I'm working on my own sort of electronic music, which I call Palimpsest.
Oh, cool.
Which is,
do you have it? Is anything available?
Nothing's available. Okay. I just started this project, and I'm really excited about it. I was over in London pecking away at the keyboard while I was in my hotel room, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it yet, but that's what I'm doing.
Good.
It's nice to be old and still have things that are like driving you that you got to do.
Yeah,
you know? And
yeah.
That's one of the pleasures of being a musician. And I love being with musicians.
Me too. That's one of the reasons I started doing this was because it's inspiring to do. Someone knocking on this door?
Yeah, somebody's knocking on the door. Maybe it means we're finished.
I think we are. Dan Workman. People can find you at Sugar Hill. Hello, come on in.
Come on in.
Yoo-hoo!
Yeah.
Hi. Do
you want to
use the service for you?
Not at all.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, we're just talking. We're almost done. Thank you, sweetie.
Thank you.
Dan Workman, people can look up Sugar Hill Studios.
SugarHillStudios.com.
And they should watch Live at Sugar Hill. That's available on the site, also
live,
on
YouTube. LiveAtSugarHill.com.
Yeah.
It's on the site. It's on YouTube.
You're going to pick that back up, you think?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Ross Wells, my partner in that caper, is chomping at the bit, ready to
Good.
Go.
Good. Well, it's a great show, and it's a great studio, and congratulations on being able to keep a big box going.
Man, thank you so much. Yeah, I'm extremely honored.
Yeah, I'm sure we should get together and hang out again. I'd like to talk to you more. I'd like to come see the studio, too.
I would like to come see the studio as well. I'd like for you to come see the studio.
All right. Thank you, man.
Thank you so much, Johnny.
Oh, yeah. Dan Workman, baby. What a great guy, man. I'm sorry about the noise. I'm sorry about the funky sound. Sorry about the DJ taking off, but it was a big show that night, and I thought that those backstage rooms at House of Blues were a little bit quieter, but apparently they're not, which is good because I was planning on doing a lot more interviews whenever we play at House of Blues because it's such a nice way to not be nervous before a show because you're sitting there doing this interview, and then all of a sudden you get done, it's time to play. That's pretty exciting. Anyway, we had a great show that night. We filmed it, and it was a fantastic, great time. Dan Workman, you know, if you're a musician out there, there's a great studio you can go to, Sugar Hill, all right? And hey, man, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. When you're there, comment and leave a rating, please. It helps us out for our overall rating. To get more involved with the show, you can go to our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Like that page, and you can always follow me on Instagram and on Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy. All right, thank you, Dan Workman, for coming here. Some more Destiny's Child. Bye-bye.
But I'm stronger. You thought that I'd be broke without you, but I'm richer. You thought that I'd be sad without you, I love harder. You thought I wouldn't grow without you, now I'm wiser. Thought that I'd be helpless without you, but I'm smarter. You thought that I'd be stressed without you, but I'm chilling. You thought I wouldn't sell without you, sold 9 million.
surviving.